Washington Football Group is doing. Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football season, all the things that go with it.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL Podcast. Steve Palazzolo here with Sam Monson. We're live a little bit earlier than usual here on YouTube. And we're going to be breaking down all the best rosters in the NFL. There'll be no debate after this. It'll be great. We'll just give you the list. You guys will accept it, and we'll go from there.
Mm. But critically, it's not our list. It's somebody else's.
So it is.
We can blame somebody else.
Always. That's the beautiful thing about not having to write everything at PFF these days, right? Like 10 years ago, Sam.
Mm-hmm.
We blame Ben Lindsay.
Yeah.
His list.
Again, didn't we crap on him for something else?
Oh, absolutely.
Else recently?
Ben is one of our better high-volume NFL writers these days. So he puts out a ton of great stuff, and he's like doing the work for us. And we get some, Ben, come on, man. You know, you just blame him.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's all Ben's fault.
How you doing?
Good. You?
Great. Got my cool clinic shirt. And listen, if you're going to watch back-to-back podcasts, this one and then maybe the 4th of July podcast, we might be wearing the same thing. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah. It's possible.
You never know.
Yeah.
But look at this cool clinic. You didn't get to see my...
I've seen that one before.
I wore it with Brenner.
Yeah.
When you were
no,
gone.
I've seen it before.
I had a white one.
Oh, okay.
I had a white
it's
one.
A different
this is
color.
This is fresh. This is new. Straight from Coach Bob Wiley.
Yeah.
Cool clinic. Yeah.
It's
5-time keynote speaker this year.
Still strikes me as a curious image to associate with offensive line play. This giant mushroom.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's the best way to play.
I mean, sure.
What are we getting into here? There are some emails that mm-hmm. we want to get to and some suggestions. And there's even, we didn't put it in the title, but a 90s Jaguars question.
Yeah. I mean, we had multiple people complaining, essentially, about how you have not commented on the big burning 90s Jags question of the day, which is the drama surrounding Tony Boselli and Bruce Smith. I think the gist of it is Bruce Smith essentially is unhappy that Tony Boselli is he in the Hall of Fame or going
in? He just got elected.
So going in this year.
Yeah.
Going into the Hall of Fame, ostensibly, according to Bruce, based off one game against Bruce Smith where he built his reputation, and that was it. He's basically saying he's not a Hall of Famer. He had one good game against me. I think he was claiming he got help and a bunch of other things in that game. And therefore, he's a fraud.
Do we need to do a watch-along? The 96 AFC divisional round game, Jaguars versus Bills? Is that what we need to do?
Oh,
you, me, and Tony, and Bruce?
You, all of us. Okay.
I mean, we'll watch and just
it does
watch
feel
them.
Very unusual that a current Hall of Famer essentially is taking a dump over the case of an incoming Hall of Famer. That doesn't tend to happen.
I just want to... I love the 90s Jags.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a crazy premise. Because, like, how did offensive linemen get their reputation back in the day? It wasn't... We didn't have PFF grading or anything like that. It really took... Hey, it's year two of Tony Boselli's career. We're in the playoffs. There's the great Bruce Smith. And we don't hear anything from Bruce Smith. He wasn't on the stat sheet or only had one tackle or whatever, and they gave all the credit to
Tony. I think offensive linemen generally were used to be massively reputation-based. And it's one thing. It's changed dramatically for a few reasons. One, PFF exists, and there's actually data points surrounding offensive linemen now, and you can't simply be a bad offensive lineman with a pedigree, like a former first-round pick, and get away with it anymore. People notice if you just stink week on week, but you were a former first round pick, there's now like actual data to show, like the guy gave up 17 sacks. He's not good. The other reason is I think the TV situation has a lot to do with it as well. Like you go back 20 years and there were guys that like you didn't see, you know what I mean? Like most people didn't see. They were buried on you know, somebody's local broadcast, and they didn't have Sunday ticket. It wasn't available for everybody at all times. So if you were able to time a really good game for a national TV audience or a playoff game when everybody is actually watching, that would offset, you know, a season. Like, you could, nobody knew what you were doing the rest of the year, but if you dominated in the playoffs, boom. Like, you're a superstar. Who the hell? He must have been doing that the whole time. We just didn't notice because he's playing in Jacksonville and nobody watches that. You know what I mean? So, and I'm not, this isn't a Tony Boselli specific thing, but I think that was generally thing that used to happen a lot. Like, Bryant McKinney's reputation as a draft prospect was built on shutting down Dwight Freeney in a game in college, where I haven't seen that game. But based off every time they played subsequently, I would bet that Bryant McKinney was given a lot of help in that game.
I'm going to look that up.
The ball came out 1 second every time, whatever. It was not a case of Bryant McKinney shutting down Dwight Freeney one-on-one, because every time those two guys played in the NFL, Dwight Freeney would wreck Bryant McKinney, who was actually, you know, a reasonable left tackle in the NFL. But that guy's reputation as a prospect was built on the size of him and that one game against Dwight Freeney in college. I don't think that happens anymore. Like, you don't, there isn't, like, look at the tackles from this draft prospect. Can you even tell, like, what is their signature game? They don't have one. Like, it's not a thing anymore.
So, yeah, there was, I mean, you can, people are always fed information that dictates what they believe, but even more so back then, where you could just say, like, when Mel Kiper says, this guy did that, right? He shut down this guy. Here's this game that he had, and here's what he did. You have to believe it, pretty much. Because you also probably couldn't go back. I mean, you certainly couldn't go back on YouTube and watch it. Right. Like, it was tough to find even just the games from the previous season unless you recorded it on VHS, right? So you can't even confirm those things. So, look, I'm a 90s Jaguars fan. I'm not a homer, though. Not a homer when it comes to those teams. I understand that Mark Brunell wasn't the best quarterback during that time. I don't know. Like, there's a lot of people pushing Fred Taylor to the Hall of Fame. I love Fred Taylor. I think he was fantastic. But Hall of Fame, I don't know. Yeah. And Boselli, my one pushback on Tony going to the Hall of Fame would be he only did it for 6 years.
Yeah. Tony Boselli has always tended to be a pretty polarizing guy. Where were you in the Boselli camp before this? Because there's some people that think Boselli is like the best left tackle that's ever played. You know, just injuries caught up to him and he didn't do it for 15 years or whatever. There are other people that are like, yeah, I mean,
I think he was really good. I mean, I do watch old Jags games and, you know, in the background and stuff like that. And I'll look up like, oh, he missed a block. But like, there's no...
Everybody does that.
Yeah, but of course, right. So I don't have any baseline. Right. I don't have the PFF baseline or anything like that. He didn't protect the blind side, Sam.
That's true. It's true.
He protected the blind side for a couple games of Steve Berline.
But you of all people can't bring that up.
But I wouldn't bring that up, no.
Yeah.
Maybe Leon Searcy at right tackle is underrated.
Is actually the Hall of Famer.
But it's a little crazy to me because Boselli's, he's played 90 games. So he was drafted in 95, and then his last full season was 2000.
Yeah.
That's it. And he missed some games in 95. He was hyped up before the Bruce Smith thing, though, too. He was the number two overall pick. I mean, He was unbelievable. He was really, really good. I don't have enough to say that he's better than Jonathan Ogden in the 90s or Walter Jones or even like Willie Rofe. Like, I don't know. What do I know if those guys are better? There were some great left tackles back then, though.
Yeah.
So I kind of agree with Bruce Smith. Not that Tony Boselli doesn't deserve to go to the Hall of Fame, but one playoff game in year two for Tony Boselli against Bruce Smith did a lot for his reputation.
Yeah.
Tony's also a big, big, strong guy. So I say, Tony, Hall of Famer. Congrats on the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
You earned it.
He certainly played at the end of the era where it was possible for that to have been a big influencing factor. Like, I think the same thing happens today. You know, I mean, Rashawn Slater is already really good, but whoever, like Penei Sewell, right? Year two comes out, the Lions make the playoffs in the wild card round. Penei Sewell like dominates Myles Garrett, NFC, AFC, whatever. The NFC equivalent, right? Dominates, you know, an awesome edge rusher in the NFC. And like, that's not creating Penei Sewell's reputation the way it could for Tony Boselli in the late 90s.
I don't know what people would have seen of Penei Sewell, but if you didn't have PFF, you would have maybe thought Penei Sewell had a terrible season last year because it started poorly. And it's that first impression, right? Penei Sewell struggling at right tackle. He was a disaster in the preseason. You may have projected that forward, But by the end of the year, we kept grading Penei Sewell well while the Lions had like one win. Nobody was watching that.
Right.
But by the end of the year, Penei Sewell had similar grades to Rashawn Slater. Better run blocking grade, worse pass blocking grade. But I think in the old days, there would have been a couple like SportsCenter highlights. Oh, look at, let's check in on first rounder Penei Sewell struggling. And you would have thought for the entire season, Penei Sewell struggled. He had a rough rookie season. Hopefully he bounces back next year. And we don't hear his name and he never has a highlight, that type of thing. But we do have the play-by-play grading now to confirm otherwise. Plus, I mean, Mark Brunell carried that entire team, carried everybody.
Hmm.
Now, I'm a realistic. I'm not a homer. I know Brunell wasn't the best quarterback. I probably wouldn't put Fred Taylor in the Hall of Fame. I know Boselli was awesome, but maybe not the best of all time.
The best player on that team is Jimmy Smith.
I do think Jimmy Smith, though. So Jimmy Smith's actually a good example with today's NFL, not to complete, you know. When Jimmy Smith was a true wide receiver one, and mm-hmm. as much as I love Mark Brunell, you saw Jimmy Smith produce with a rookie Byron Leftwich, year two Byron Leftwich. I think there was a little crossover to even David Garrard too through 2005, but like Leftwich didn't have a good NFL career, but Jimmy Smith was still dominating at that point, right? He was QB proof no matter who was throwing to him. And even when Brunell got hurt, the Jaguars had backup quarterbacks who had a lot of success. Jimmy Smith is the guy that probably is the best player on that team, along with Boselli, I would say.
You know, and can't seem to sniff the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and Tony Brackens. I mean, Tony Brackens was Miles Garrett-level dominant, but only did it for about 3 years. Forget six.
All right, so as I say, multiple people messaged in complaining that you hadn't yet addressed it. So that's the official Steve Palazzolo stance on the Bruce Smith, Tony Boselli.
Is that official enough?
Controversy.
I kind of agree with Bruce. But I love Tony.
Bruce is also a large man that you probably don't want to upset, like,
yeah, we never know when we're going to run into these guys. So
walking a hard place there, right? Which giant angry man do I want to upset?
Less afraid of Fred Taylor, more afraid of Tony Boselli and Bruce Smith.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's reasonable. Okay, other emails. A lot of people like the idea, our PFF versus the fans concept.
That has caught on, I think,
already. By the way, when I say our, like, we stole it from whoever emailed it in suggesting it as an idea.
It's a great idea.
But we've adopted it. We like it, and the people like it.
Send that person something.
True. So we've had a few Patriots ones. The first one from a guy called Sean DePorter, who sent a long email with all kinds of tangents about his kid applying for PFF back in the day and like a tourist guide to Massachusetts at the end. But his problem was he wasn't clear on the specifics of his challenge, right? Of the Sean versus PFF thing. And this is where this thing, you know, love the emails we're getting through of, you know, where we're wrong, where we can essentially bet against you during the season and keep a tally of them and those people win things. But it's got to be specific enough that we can, you know, act on it, right?
Right.
So just like you're wrong about the Patriots, not really enough to go on. And this guy was a little bit more specific than that, but didn't really hone in on it. The second one was from somebody called Jake, who says, the take of PFFs that I'm challenging is the draft grade of the Patriots, which was a D. The worst draft grade we gave out and the worst draft grade that pretty much everybody gave out. The way I intend to do this is by wagering that the Patriots' first three picks, Cole Strange, Tyquan Thornton, and Marcus Jones, all add more war relative to their positions than the first three picks of the Baltimore Ravens, excluding Ajabo, who, you know, obviously redshirt injury type of deal, Kyle Hamilton, Tyler Linderbaum, and Travis Jones. You gave the Ravens an A+, and I believe the Patriots picks will add more value at their positions than the Ravens do at theirs. I'm not saying that the results will justify the bad process. I agree that the Patriots reached, but I think that the bad process has led to an unfair criticism of the players and what they'll add to the team. Thanks for everything you both do. Jake.
So that's a good bet.
That's a great bet.
Clear terms.
Yes.
A declaration, right? Top three Patriots picks versus top three Ravens picks. War relative to their position. I got that in PFF IQ. I could pull that out pretty easily. Of course, we'll be honest about that.
Well, you can put it on the screen. Prove it.
Yeah, I can put it on the screen.
Yeah.
Be honest about that.
I mean, I wouldn't trust you being honest, so you know, you have to give
it
something.
We have to prove it out? Yeah. Okay. Can do that. So, yeah, I like that.
That's great, but that's exactly what we're looking for, right? A, you're wrong. You're wrong, hugely wrong, because you gave a D versus an A+. B, I'm willing to bet on it, and here are the terms. And the terms are like perfectly fair. That's a ballsy bet. Like, you could have, you know, been wishy-washy about that and went, well, you know, and done something that sort of focuses on starting time and all that kind of thing.
So what we should do...
Full PFF. I love that.
We didn't prepare Tyler for this or anything. What we should do going forward is have the bet terms throw a graphic up there, and we can accept or decline the terms.
Okay.
Right? So we can do that going forward. So the terms are Patriots first three picks, first the Ravens first three picks, take out Ojabo.
And we're going to have,
per season. We're going to just do year one, or are we doing...
It's got to be year one.
Let's just do year one.
What we should do is, at some point, fire all these into a Google document that everybody can have access to.
Oh.
View access. We're not going to, you know...
Yeah, we can't let people doctor it up.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Oh, looks like I bet here, and it turns out I'm 100% right. No, view access only for people of the show. But so everybody can see the bets that we've got rolling live and see how they're working out.
I like this a lot. People like betting. What do they get if they're wrong? Nothing, huh?
It's essentially a... It's a no-loss proposition.
They're going to lose their reputation.
Yeah. Because
we'll call them out.
Well, no, because they don't really have a reputation to lose. The first introduction of them to the PFF audience is going to be this.
Yeah.
So they can try and gain a reputation. They're hoping to establish a reputation with this bet, but they can't lose one.
I mean, if we really want to spice it up a little bit, we'd have them offer something. We'll put up PFF Edge. Maybe they could put up, some coffee or something.
I mean, look, if you've got something to offer, by all means, spice it up. But
we'll put a donation button.
But it's not necessary.
Yeah. I'm just messing around. So, yeah, this will be fun. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. That is a perfect example of the kind of wager bet argument that we're looking for. NFLpodcast@pff.com is the email to send, whatever it is you want to bet and argue about. But that, I think, is our first official one. The PFF versus the fans, the Patriots draft class.
The other thing people should do is go to Underdog Fantasy, because that's the best place to play fantasy football this summer. Their Best Ball Mania tournament has $10 million in total prize money. And the best part is you just draft your fantasy football team and that's it. There's no waivers, no trades, no in-season management. Underdog gives you your best score each week of the season, and the highest scores at the end of the year win. The champion of Best Ball Mania last year drafted in June, so there's no time like the present to join Underdog and take your shot at a $1 million draft. Plus, Underdog is going to double your first deposit up to $100 when you sign up with the promo code PFF. Also, if you play 10 of those dollars using promo code PFF, you get a free PFF subscription. So what are you waiting for? Head to underdogfantasy.com or the App Store, play $10 with code PFF, and draft your Best Ball Mania team today. All right, Sam, do we have any other emails? Do we want to get into this best roster stuff?
We had one that was an interesting discussion from Brandon Stringer, who essentially was arguing that bridge quarterbacks are a waste of time now. You've heard that running backs don't matter, but this one is all the more true. Bridge quarterbacks don't matter. Andy Dalton did nothing for Fields but take his snaps or reps. Trubisky, Mariota, etc. signings are all just flushing cap down the drain. Mason Rudolph and Felipe Franks could have tided them over and been younger with whatever potential that brings. Thanks. Are bridge quarterbacks now just a waste of time, cap space, roster spots, everything?
It depends on how you're judging them. I mean, if you're trying to say, well, the Bears didn't get wins out of Andy Dalton.
Well, literally, Andy Dalton. I mean, the Andy Dalton one is a good example if you're trying to make this case, because he did literally nothing for the Chicago Bears last season, in addition to taking up time that probably would have been useful for Justin Fields. Right? Remember, Nate Tice also re-highlighted somebody else's point. Remember, Trevor Lawrence had to split reps with Gardner Minshew last training camp, because presumably Urban Meyer was really going hard to try and build
the coach who kicked their kicker.
Yeah, had to really establish a winning culture. So Trevor Lawrence wasn't even getting the full... Gardner Minshew potentially is a great bridge quarterback for somebody, but if he's just taking Trevor Lawrence's snaps, what good is that?
I would say that the benefit is in the thing that we can't quantify, right? If there's a benefit, it is in the fact that if you interview Justin Fields, how was it having Andy Dalton around? Oh, he helped me learn how to watch film and what to look at and prepare and how to be a professional and all that stuff. Like, that stuff's real.
Right.
That stuff does exist.
But that doesn't need to be a bridge quarterback. Two things. One, you can use my old tried and true strategy of just hire a quarterback coach.
Hire Matt Castle.
Right.
No, but it's a little...
Josh McCown. Hire Josh McCown as a quarterback coach. You don't have to take up a roster spot. You don't have to pay him a ton of money. And he can teach Justin Fields all of those things just as well as Andy Dalton can. Job done. Number two...
It's a little different
number
when it's
two,
your peer.
If you insist that he has to be an active quarterback for some reason, He can just be a veteran backup. He doesn't have to be a bridge guy. He can just be a dude that, like, sits on the ass end of somebody's roster, and that's all. That's his entire purpose. I am just here as a living, walking example of what you should be doing. But I'm never going to start because I'm me.
Part of it is watching without them teaching, right? You're just watching. You're observing. Yeah. You're peer in how they do things. Now, on the other side of that, I don't know how much it actually matters, right? It's one of those things where if you say in sports, like, phrases like, oh, this guy's 10 times ahead of where he was last year at this time. Okay, well, it's not going to translate to 10 times better performance, right? So does it actually matter? Because at the end of the day, what you actually do on the field is the only thing that matters technically, right? All the inputs are like how well you work out, what you learned, knowing the playbook, and all that stuff. All those inputs lead to the output, which is how well you play on the field. And one of the inputs is like, I learned how to be a professional. I learned how to do this. I learned how to study film. But if it doesn't actually make you better on the field, that's where it doesn't necessarily have value. So there's probably some value there in having the bridge quarterback. I don't think the cap space matters because that's not Andy Dalton's cap isn't affecting this year. It's not affecting the future of the next quarterback.
No, but it matters if you eventually do turn to the rookie and he's out there, you know, doing what he can, and you have the equivalent of a slot wide receiver salary being taken up in the dude that he just put in the bench. It's not insignificant. I mean, that's we've talked about for 20 years. Like, Tom Brady has done that, right? He's given the Patriots largely, and now the Bucks, essentially a slot receiver for free, right? With the amount of money he's leaving on the table relative to the best paid player at the position every single year.
But that's
the same thing here.
But I always look at, say, the rookie quarterback as, I don't care about year one. I care about years 2, 3, 4, 5, right? Andy Dalton's salary isn't affecting this year's hypothetical slot receiver or anything like that. Who cares about year one? Care about the future.
But if he's good year one, it's relevant.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you get another evaluation. Look, it matters if you do believe that reps are the most important thing. That Fields should have had more reps, or Trey Lance should have had more reps, or whatever it might be. Garoppolo wasn't a bridge. He was just better. But I don't know. Just
Dolphins, if you believe in reps. $5 million dead cap money this year.
Maybe they should have structured that a little bit better. maybe they didn't need to invest 2 years in Andy Dalton to make a point. That's different.
Matters a little bit.
A true bridge quarterback is a 1 year investment. You got to do the bridge quarterback thing correctly.
You give them all the money year one. Yeah. I tend to agree with the notion that it's a waste of time. I think unless your rookie quarterback actually requires a year on the bench, the bridge quarterback is doing nothing for you. Nothing that you couldn't get from hiring Josh McCown as a quarterback coach for, like, you know, whatever that costs. Low six-figure contract and no roster spot.
So the answer is maybe.
I mean, the answer to me is yes. Like, unless your quarterback needs a year on the bench to start. And I think we might be reaching a point in the NFL where if that's a prerequisite of the quarterback, I'm not sure he's actually an NFL quarterback anymore. Like, can you think of a quarterback in recent years who needed a year to learn on the bench and then became great?
Needed a year on
needed,
the bench?
Required that year.
Again,
to
we
be
don't
built up from scratch.
We don't know
right.
if that's what led to Patrick Mahomes or Carson Palmer both being
right,
really
but
good.
The talk and then so the two data points in Patrick Mahomes to suggest it wasn't necessary were a constant stream of reports saying that he was lighting it up in practice, et cetera, and the only reason he's on the bench is because Alex Smith is currently leading the NFL in passer rating and okay. deep passing and all that kind of stuff. And he then gets in week 17, crushes it, and we're like, wow, Patrick Mahomes is really good.
I don't necessarily buy those data points because you're saying there was this highlight reel of practice. Yeah, that was kind of the expectation from Patrick Mahomes. The thing that I contend, the thing that has made him great is the fact that he works well within structure.
Sure. I'm not saying
is it fair to make the assumption that 16 weeks sitting has helped him develop that skill, which was necessary, right? The thing that makes Patrick Mahomes so special is that when you read his scouting report coming out of college, every single weakness he turned into a strength. Playing within structure and decision-making and accuracy, whatever it was. So
Yeah.
Did that 16 weeks matter?
I don't know. But I think there's a big... The other sort of thing about Patrick Mahomes is that, like, he obviously is just different to what people thought he was. Like, the negatives in college as a scouting report were more question marks. Like, can he do this within structure? Not that he can't. Like, it's not...
He just didn't do it in Texas Tech.
It's not like he was... Yeah. It's not like he was overtly bad at this stuff and then turned them into being strengths and that's why he's so good. It's like... I don't see evidence of him playing within the structure. Like, he just doesn't do it and doesn't have to and dominates it. Like, can he do that at the next level? Because that is the difference between, you know, quarterbacks that can thrive that way and guys that get to the next level have to play in structure and can't. So to me, there's a very big possibility that, like, Patrick Mahomes was just that guy pretty much the whole way. And, you know, had he been thrown in year one, we would have seen that anyway. I'm not saying that those data points automatically mean that that's true, but that's the way I would lean if I was evaluating Patrick Mahomes. Who else has had to sit for a year and is like, he's the only
Brady,
but yeah, I mean, Mahomes is the only guy that's done it recently, right? That sat for a serious length of time and then turned into something really good.
This is why I don't know what to do with the data point of did you sit or did you start right away, right?
Yeah, I don't,
because there's a point where you're like, well, Aaron Rodgers sat.
Right.
Drew Brees didn't start right away. Tom Brady didn't start right away. Patrick Mahomes didn't start right away. Of the elite quarterbacks of the last 20 to 25 years, only Peyton Manning stepped right in as the starter immediately. He's the only guy. Again, this feels like us telling coaches, this is a must-go on fourth down when it adds like 2% of win probability. This is a must-go, but it's not like... it's going to change your win probability by 90 to 100%. It doesn't mean you're going to get it 100% of the time. It just means we're talking about fractions of a percentage point. And if we don't have the AB analysis, right? We can't see. What if Tom Brady started right away as a sixth round pick in the year 2000? What if Patrick Mahomes started in 2017? We don't have that analysis to put up against their sitting.
Yeah, this is all kind of my point, though. It's like, to me, the sit or don't sit thing is very much I don't think there's a wrong or a right answer. At best, it's like, who the hell knows? This is a coin flip. There's no obvious difference either way. So I think you probably conclude that it doesn't really make a difference either way. So if you're then coming to me and saying, this guy has to sit for a year, well, there's no real evidence to say that does anything for anybody. So if that guy has to sit for a year, why is he going to be good at the end of that year? And if he is, then you probably should have played him from year one, at which point the bridge quarterback was a waste of everybody's time. So my conclusion to all this is there is no such thing as a quarterback that has to sit for a year in order for him to be any good in the NFL. He's either going to be good or he's not, at which point the bridge quarterback is a waste of time. Completely, across the board. They serve no purpose, because their only purpose would be to stave a guy from starting year one who shouldn't be starting year one, which I'm not sure is a thing anymore, if it ever was.
Walt in the chat is yelling, Carson Palmer. I did mention Carson Palmer. He did sit for a year, right? Tactically, yeah. Sat for a year. I wonder if it just comes down to supporting cast, right? It's not...
Palmer is the last guy, I think, that has actually made it the year of the plan,
yeah.
You know, because everyone comes in with this plan of, oh, this guy's going to sit for a year. We've got this quarterback that we're going to have as the bridge. This guy's going to take the lumps this year. We'll develop him on the sideline. Next year is when we're going to see him. I think Palmer's the last guy that's actually made it the full year, and we haven't seen him until
Mahomes technically did. He only started week 17 because the Chiefs were clinched in the playoffs.
But he did start week 17.
Right, we did.
Nobody else has made it the whole year. Everyone else is at some point just like throw him out there. Blake Bortles, who's supposed to have the year on the sideline, lasted like 4.5 games or something.
But your point is always the quarterback that they currently have does matter in their decision process. And my point is it shouldn't, right? The fact that Chad Henne was the guy that was keeping Blake Bortles on the bench, that's where they were like, fine, let's get Blake out there. But in Carson Palmer's case, they had John Kitna, I think, had like a career year or whatever in 2003 or whatever it was, 2004.
Which is part of the reason. I mean, that's why I say it matters, because the guy you have starting essentially dictates how long you have to give the guy on the sideline. John Kitna has a career year, ergo you don't have to put in Carson Palmer.
You were
Blake
sitting
Bortles
here.
Sits behind Chad Henne. You get four games before you're like, I can't take another minute of Chad Henne dropping back, getting sacked, and throwing the ball back towards his own end zone. I need to put in the rookie. I don't care how bad it is. I don't care what it does for his development. I can't watch another second of Chad Henne. Like, that's the decision-making that happens.
you were here all last year saying Justin Fields shouldn't start because the situation's poor, right? We don't have great receivers. We don't have a great offensive line. Let Andy Dalton take the lumps, especially you didn't even want him to play against the Rams or certain teams and all that stuff. But maybe that is actually the thing, right? Where it's the only thing that can hurt our rookie quarterback's development is getting a little gun shy in the pocket, taking too many hits, not trusting his protection, not trusting the system. But if you do have a guy step into a good situation, maybe it's better. At the same time, you know, like Jared Goff and Carson Wentz. Jared Goff, his rookie season, stepped into maybe the worst situation in the NFL and looked terrible. Carson Wentz stepped into one of the best offensive lines, looked pretty good, and their career trajectories are all over the place. Goff was fine the next year. Wentz was an MVP candidate. Then he dropped off. Goff got better. There's no direct path with any of this stuff. There's no good answer.
Well,
we just spent 20 minutes talking about there's no good answer.
I think the point you're making there is that supporting cast is one of the most important parts in terms of any kind of quarterback's development. And there's definitely an argument, but again, this isn't necessarily a bridge quarterback. There is definitely an argument that if the situation is so bad that the rookie can't possibly be expected to have any kind of success, don't play him because all you're doing is harming the quarterback.
But we also don't even know that that's the case.
Yeah, I think that probably is, though.
We don't know that that's the case. Again, Goff, he only played 5 games or whatever it was, but was in a horrible situation. He was trash, but you got Sean McVay in there the next year, and Goff looked good. And then they were in the Super Bowl 2 years later.
Yeah, but the situation was better. Like, they also McVay, the offense is better. They overhauled the offense.
But playing
line.
In the bad situation didn't hinder his ability to play well when the good situation showed up.
No, but it certainly didn't help. Like, my point being, the only thing that can happen there is bad. Like, I don't think there's anything to be gained from, like, half a dozen games of getting your ass kicked in a terrible situation. I don't think that does you any good whatsoever. I think it can definitely do you harm, but I don't think that that's helpful for a young quarterback. I don't like the idea that the idea with Peyton Manning, right, was you go out there, you take your lumps, you know, you go through the fire, and then you're tempered by it, and you're stronger at the other end. But, like, that was more to do with sort of learning the mistakes, you know what I mean? Like, figure out, like, what you can and can't do at this level. Like, throw the ball, yeah. You're going to make some errors, and you're not going to make them again, right? That idea of, was it Bruce Arians? There's a story of Peyton Manning in some sort of film review session way back when he was a kid. Young quarterback. And I think it was Bruce Arians. So, like, here, pause the tape here. Why didn't you throw to the tight end here? He's like, coach's covered. Like, Bruce Arians, like, what are you talking? Like, that's open in the NFL. That ball needs to come out of your hands and go to the tight end there. And that's the process that Peyton Manning had to go through, right? Is learning what NFL open looks like, learning what isn't NFL open.
What cover two is.
Right, and it's going to be an interception. Like, those things, right? It isn't you need to go out there and be destroyed for 16 games because that's useful for your development going forward. Like, no, that's not a thing. Like, get Jared Goff just playing terribly and being just re-wrecked by the team is not helpful. Jared Goff playing to, like, learn where the errors are is useful, but I don't think those things cross over that often.
And you don't think he's going to learn from mistakes because he doesn't know where the sun rises.
I mean, I'm just saying that would lead me to question, you know, how well he takes on information.
We have some revisionist history when it comes to Peyton Manning's rookie season, and people only look at, hey, he had 26 interceptions. Look at Peyton. Hey, look at all these guys who don't have 26 interceptions. They're going to be better. When Peyton was actually really good as a rookie, he just happened to have a lot of interceptions because they were an aggressive play from behind team.
And, you know, you had to learn where all the mistakes were.
And all that. So the bridge quarterback, overrated for you.
I jump on the party political platform that says the bridge quarterback is a waste of time and should be eliminated. I'm there.
I am team bridge quarterback.
Of course you are.
I would still do it. I would still bridge it. Still use
the
it. But your alternative is like, yeah, give me Mason Rudolph. Give me the guy that's a little bit of an unknown. He's younger. He's not going to be as good at teaching my rookie quarterback how to be a professional, blah, 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 blah. I'll take my lumps with this other guy.
The only purpose I can see to a bridge quarterback is if you think the situation is so bad that throwing the rookie out there will harm him, right? And you didn't have an alternative. So look at the last 2 draft classes of quarterbacks, for example, right? You could argue that the situation in Jacksonville or New York was bad enough that you shouldn't take the rookie, You shouldn't take a rookie quarterback, because if you play him, he's going to do exactly what he just did. He's going to put a PFF grade in the 50s. He's going to look terrible, and you could actually do him serious harm long term. It's going to be year two or three before we can put a team around this guy to give him any kind of chance of success whatsoever. So you shouldn't take a quarterback this year. Okay, but then the next year you can show up and there's no rookie quarterbacks, right? You stink again for a year. You're building. Now you get the top, you know, you get a top pick again. Jacksonville, you're back at number one. Uh-oh. If you hadn't taken Trevor Lawrence, like, what's your plan now? Because there's no quarterback this year. So I think sometimes you just have to take the quarterback and figure out, you know, adjust the rebuild. That is when I could see an argument for, okay, guys, this is the worst situation in the NFL. If this guy goes out here year one, all we can do is make him worse. So let's throw out Chad Henne instead because, you know, he's earned his money. Like Chase Daniel, right? Let's throw out Chase Daniel and make him finally earn that $41 million he's had in his career, right? That's the plan this year, because we're going to stink anyway. It's a terrible situation, and Chase Daniel's earned $41 million in his career already. I don't care if we break him, you know? That's the only purpose I can see to a
Yeah, you wanted the Bears to play Andy Dalton over Justin Fields last year.
Yeah, because I thought there was a pretty big chance that the Bears could actually hurt Justin, not physically, but ruin Justin Fields. That is the purpose of a bridge quarterback to me, is to just prevent you damaging the most valuable asset on your team.
Gentlemen, all men strive for gold in their life, right? Gold watches, gold medals, gold everything. However, there's a certain type of man who goes the extra mile. He walks with the confidence of an eagle from Philadelphia and giggles in the face of danger. He's a big, hairless, winning machine. And when he unzips his pants, he sees platinum. Platinum, that's right, Manscaped. They'd like to introduce you to their best and biggest ultimate hygiene bundle yet. It's the Platinum Package 4.0. Manscaped is the leader in below-the-waist grooming. Now, trust them with the whole shebang. Join 4 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped by going to manscaped.com for 20% off plus free shipping with the code PFF. Manscaped's brand new Platinum Package 4.0 is the biggest bundle they've ever offered, giving you a bulk discount on Manscaped's top products. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code PFF at manscaped.com. That's 20% off plus free shipping. Manscaped.com. Use the code PFF. It's time you enjoyed the finer things in life and get yourself a platinum package for your platinum package, Sam.
That's another reason that you shouldn't have a bridge quarterback. Everybody strives for platinum, not gold.
Because Manscaped.
You want platinum.
Platinum. You want the platinum.
You want the platinum. And a bridge quarterback's never given you the platinum.
Never. All right. Ready to trash Ben Lindsay? Just kidding. We're going to support our colleague, Ben Lindsay, here. PFF.com. Also on ESPN.com. Ranking the best rosters in the NFL. It's an annual article. We do it all the time. Everybody hates it. They get mad at it. We had a GM enter the room one time because, you know, NFL Combine, every year we meet with all of our teams. And he came in the room and he said, "Who ranked us 31st last year in roster?" And we're all just kind of like, "That was us." He said, "Yeah, you're right. We were bad." He backed us up. He didn't get mad. Other GMs have yelled at us and gotten mad.
Yeah.
Maybe they're friends now. But this guy actually said, "You're right. We're going to do a lot better." And I'll just say that GM has gone on to do much better work since then, since they ranked 31st. So where do you want to start with this? The best rosters in the NFL. You want to start at the top? Who's the best?
Yeah.
Buffalo Bills.
Yeah.
Agree or disagree?
Agree. The Bills are the top team in most people's power rankings. They are the favorite. Am I correct in saying that? The betting favorite for the Super Bowl at the moment. And they rank number one in this roster breakdown. And those things are connected. The Bills have the best roster in the NFL. That's why they're the favorites, right? The fact that they didn't make it as far as other teams last season in the playoffs. Like, we know, like, in the playoffs, they were the favorite. They were dominating. They were on a really good run, and they came 13 seconds away from knocking over the Chiefs. Who knows if they'd have beaten the Bengals or not, but, like, we're not a million miles away from last season's Buffalo team being a Super Bowl team. And this season's version added players like Von Miller to address one of their biggest weaknesses. Not biggest weaknesses, but an area of concern, I guess. It's a really good roster.
When you were out, we had Greg Rosenthal on the show. We did something similar because he was going through each of the rosters and kind of ranking them. And I think we came to the conclusion, if I remember correctly, that the Bills also, on that show, he had said they were number one. The one place where we talked about maybe there's some concern is the offensive line. The idea that there's a little bit of turnover there. There's a little bit more pressure on second-year tackle Spencer Brown, a guy like Ryan Bates who has played well at guard in limited time. You bring in a Roger Saffold who's a very good veteran but had a rough year last year in pass protection with the Titans. That could be the place, right? I mean, the offensive line, we always talk about the Bills as this kind of standard for building around the young quarterback, right? They got the offensive line to manageable, crept back toward average, and then stacked up playmakers for Josh Allen, and that coincided directly with his development. But this actually could be the worst offensive line he has since year one for Josh Allen. I don't think it's a disaster or anything like that. I still think it's in the middle of the pack in the NFL, but I do wonder if that is the potential weakness on this team. On the bright side, you mentioned they bring in Von Miller, draft Kyer Elam to be that number two cornerback opposite Tre'Davious White. You lose Levi Wallace in the process, but yes, handling some of those places with good players like Von Miller, first-round pick at corner, I think should make Bills fans feel pretty good.
Yeah, their offensive line doesn't look great on paper. On the other hand, it kind of never does. Like, that's part of, I think, their strategy on the offensive line has been kind of what we preached, you know, creep back toward average, but they're not so much creeping back there. They're there. They've been average, and they're trying to maintain average. And their strategy, I think, for maintaining average is let's just assemble as many average players on the offensive line as humanly possible. You know, teams kind of platoon nine guys in the offensive line. If we get nine average guys, the chances of us having a terrible offensive line are pretty small. I think that's been their plan. It's worked. The only worry about that is it is a small chance, but it's still there. Nobody plays at the same level every single year. So if you get five average guys, you know, you're going to get this range of outcomes every single year for each one of those guys. And if like three of them, you know, hit the bad end in a given season, all of a sudden your offensive line becomes a problem because now you got three below average players versus two guys that aren't offsetting it by being superstars, you know, or maybe offsetting it by above average play if you get the other end of the variance. And now still you've got kind of three weak links on an offensive line, and that is kind of problematic. And I think the Bills flirted with that a little bit last season, and I think that's the one kind of flaw with that strategy, as I think that's always a threat. Like at any given moment, three of those guys could be a problem because none of them are great.
They also, I should have mentioned, they bring in David Questenberry too. So he's got a history of being average, had a good year last year run blocking. Our listeners are so astute. When the Bills signed Greg Van Roten, who is, you know, one of those guys that you just described, somebody's like, PFF Steve must love this. Yes, I do. Greg Van Roten, a guy that plays guard and could be decent and has been decent. Whatever. So the Bills have a really good roster. I agree. They're very good. They replaced Cole Beasley with Jamison Crowder. Gabriel Davis on the outside. We'll see if he continues to develop. And, you know, the star power that he showed in the playoffs, I don't want to overrate just the playoff run because he had been good previously too. But if he handles a little bit more volume opposite Stephon Diggs, those are all the things that people are looking at when they rank the Bills really high from a roster standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at a lot of rosters, you can find an obvious area of weakness and say, this is the thing that's going to cause some problems. It's tough to find that with Buffalo. And okay, some of it relies on rookies coming in and playing, and that can be risky. You know, James Cook has the potential to propel this team in a different direction on offense, but they're kind of insulated. If James Cook doesn't do that, if he stinks, if he's not good, doesn't matter. They're in the same position as last year in terms of running backs. Kyer Elam comes in a corner. Again, the potential is there for him to be a much better player than the player he replaced. And that, I think, insulates them from the idea that he doesn't play that well. Like, Levi Wallace played reasonably well for, particularly his sort of play is more relative to his story, right? Like, former walk-on at Alabama, goes from walk-on to undrafted to, you know, clinging on to a starting job for a few years. He has a reasonably easy job opposite Tre'Davious White, which helps. That all translates to Kyer Elam as well, right? He, rookie corner, doesn't often lead to dramatic success. On the other hand, he's going to have the same benefit of that relatively easy job opposite Tre'Davious White, and he doesn't have to be great to be better than the guy he's replacing.
I was deep in the research the other day, and I proved it, that Levi Wallace may have a slightly easier job than Tre'Davious White.
I'm not interested in any data point that tells me that Levi Wallace is going to
I know
be
you
bad
love Levi Wallace.
Which I suspect might happen.
But I may have stumbled upon an insight that corners play into the boundary, you know, the short side of the field, which doesn't matter as much in the NFL theoretically, the boundary versus the field, that those guys, the boundary corner, the guy that's closest to the ball, actually has it a little bit more difficult. Playing the X receiver, specifically usually playing the X receiver, whatever it might be. And Levi plays to the field a lot. That's all.
Okay.
Just saying. Maybe he had a slightly easier path that's helping his grade along just a little bit.
Yeah, but the point being, that should also help Kyrie Elam adjust.
Agreed. Absolutely. So how about the next teams here? We got the Bucs at 2. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles Chargers at 3, ahead of Super Bowl defending champion Los Angeles Rams at 4.
Wow.
And then the Green Bay Packers at 5. And I know we've talked a lot about the Packers receivers, and I just want to go back historically through this exercise, right? The Eagles are a great example, and I reference them a lot here. They had years where they were always top 5, top 7. They're right this year, they're 7 in roster strength. But where the Eagles were strong was in the trenches, and they always felt really weak at receiver and corner until they made that better. In 2017, they win a Super Bowl. Are the Packers similar? They've got great corners. That's one of the reasons why they're up here. The Packers having the 5th best roster strength, is that based off, obviously, the quarterback? You have Aaron Rodgers, and you go position by position, and everything's good, 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 good. Defense looks good. But the biggest weakness on paper is receiver.
Yeah.
And if the Packers, they might have the 5th best all-around roster, but if receiver is actually a weakness next year, and we don't have people emerge, and we don't have Aaron Rodgers dragging them, it doesn't matter. They won't have the 5th best record. They won't be in the, I don't think it matters.
I mean, if you gave them Buffalo's receiving core, they'd have the best roster in the NFL. Like, that's where Green Bay has arguably the best roster in the NFL, but they have maybe one of the worst receiving cores in the NFL. Like, that's, it's, you know, like when you rank receiving cores generally, when you rank receiving groups, like, how far can you go with a team that has like one player? You know, one good receiver and everybody else stinks.
Yeah.
Like, how high can you put that team? The Packers are sort of, well, how high can you put a team where the roster is great, but this one really important position group is bad. It's terrible. Like, it's probably the worst receiving group Aaron Rodgers has ever thrown to. The only other, I think, argument for that was 2015, where he lost Jordy Nelson in the preseason to a torn ACL, right? So his number one receiver went down right before the season. They didn't have the ability to replace that. That's the kind of receiving group he's throwing to right now. It's as if his number one guy has been, you know, taken out of the game right before the season, which is kind of true, but you traded him away instead of he tore his ACL. The other interesting thing about that season, by the way, now look, you're going back, so it's Mike McCarthy. It's like, how much of it is Mike McCarthy's offense? But the only season where Rodgers basically hasn't had a number one receiver to throw to, and it was his lowest PFF grade ever of his career. So, you know, if you're looking at Rodgers now, okay, things are different. No Mike McCarthy, better offense, you know, all these things. On the other hand, the last time he had a group of receivers this bad, he graded in the 70s, and he had a 90 grade either side of that, you know, years. So 2014, 2016... elite Aaron Rodgers, 2015, worst Aaron Rodgers we've ever seen because there was no Jordy Nelson there. I'm not saying that's going to happen this year, but if I was a Green Bay fan looking at this receiving group and then, you know, that data point came across my radar, that would make me upset.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the point I wanted to make in this whole thing. We're ranking entire rosters. When Ben goes through this process, and we had eyes on this list before too, so we always joke that it's all Ben, right? But when Ben goes through this process, we are weighing whether it's mathematically, or at least in our head, yeah, quarterback obviously is a thing, and receiving group, and where we think the positions need to be stronger. But the Packers will be an interesting case where I do agree the roster top to bottom is really, really good, but the biggest weakness could make them take a massive step back this
year.
Are
we overrating the Chargers roster based off what it looks like on paper before we've seen it actually manifest? Are we on fire again?
Is that a fire alarm?
Hard to tell. Let's just hope it isn't.
I hear somebody walking upstairs. Now, let's see, this is where you miss Austin, too. Like, if Austin got up and sprinted upstairs.
Well, that could mean anything. That could mean
that's true.
The building's on fire, or it could mean going to the loo.
He just needs more coffee.
Yeah.
We good? The alarm's off? Back to your question, Sam.
Yeah.
We'll just cut that out of the podcast. That's what we do. We never cut anything. Are we overrating the Chargers?
Based off, what it looks like on paper versus actually seeing it manifest on the field and how it gels and works together, et cetera, et cetera.
I'd say probably, because my general take is that Khalil Mack, superstar name, and I actually use Khalil Mack all the time, superstar name in football is not as impactful as superstar name in other sports, right? But we still get the emotional feeling of when you look back at this offseason and you say the Chargers added Khalil Mack, J.C. Jackson, two huge names in free agency and guys that have been really productive. Of course, we look at other pieces too, but those are the big pieces. We probably overrate those guys a little bit. At the same time, when you go top to bottom, my Chargers takes aren't necessarily based off that. It's year three of Herbert. It's having their receiving core locked in. It's having their offensive line, the development that they made last year. It's adding other little pieces along the defensive line where it was a big weakness. And then, oh, by the way, they also have Khalil Mack and J.C. Jackson. I do think in the player. And I do think in Bryce Callahan. All of that stuff added up does have the Chargers probably in the top five.
Yeah, so it's a little bit like some of the players they've added in the secondary in particular. It's like we really liked them as players and we've seen great play from them, or the potential is there for great play, but it either hasn't happened for a while or hasn't happened yet. So remember when the Chargers first started adding players, it's like, oh, they bring in Chris Harris, add to the player, and you know, the guys that they already, Casey Hayward already. It's like, this team's going to be incredible. Like, that's already one of the best secondaries in the NFL. And then that was the start of the decline of Chris Harris, and Casey Hayward fell off a cliff that year before bouncing back with the Raiders. The player obviously gets injured because somebody mentioned his name. And all of a sudden, what looked like maybe the best secondary in the NFL on paper completely fell apart. We didn't see that at all. This is kind of the same, right? You bring in J.C. Jackson, who's been really good, and in particular, a ball hawk sort of above and beyond what his PFF grade says he has. You know, so a little bit like Trayvon Diggs in terms of his impact has probably been more than his down-to-down grading in terms of turning over the ball, you know, the EPA that brings and all, so leading to wins a little bit better. On the other hand, like, how many players have left New England on defense and maintained their level? So just a little, you know, Asante Samuel Jr., love that guy's profile coming out, literally was the embodiment of his father, you know, 20 years later or whatever we are.
By the way, Asante Samuel Sr. would be one of the guys
He's probably the last one.
The last guy that probably left the Patriots, had success, had success elsewhere.
So, you know, Asante Samuel Jr., love the guy's skill set, love what he can be. On the other hand, great last year, 56. Bryce Callahan had a year where he was the best slot corner in the NFL and moonlighted outside, played incredibly, like one of the best seasons we've seen from a corner last year, grade of 60. Like, didn't, you know, hasn't maintained that level. The player, incredible skill set, always one guy calling him out, you know, mentioning him by name away from, like, you know, breaking something and not playing for the
season. Number
three. Yeah. And then Nasir Adderley, good, maybe hasn't become the player that he thought. But anyway, my point being, you've got five guys there where if it all comes together, it's a little bit like, remember last year's Indianapolis Colts wide receiver group? So you can definitely paint a picture where it comes together and it's amazing. On the other hand, it probably won't. This one, I think, is an easier picture to paint, but it kind of feels like we're doing the same thing, right? We're putting it together and we're automatically assuming it's going to be the best end of the range of outcomes. Whereas in reality, two of those guys are probably going to play where they played last year. We're not going to see, you know, it's not going to be the best season from all of them, and therefore it won't be as good as everybody thinks it will be.
Would you take them out of the top five, though? Because I get your point. Even like the Chris Harris point.
When
I compliment a move like, hey, Chris Harris, like, you know that there's some downside, but I think you just stack up a bunch of those moves, like a Bryce Callahan, trying to get him back on track or whatever. And those are good process overall.
I would argue that Cleveland's roster is probably better than theirs, particularly if we're giving them the benefit of the doubt of having Deshaun Watson, which it looks like we are in this.
In this one, we were. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what we're going to end up.
I could see an argument for Green Bay, though, with the wide receiver group. I can also understand why you wouldn't. I mean, Philadelphia's roster might be better, even if they're much worse at quarterback.
I think I'm lower on the Browns this year than I was last year from a roster perspective. because you're losing, you don't have J.C. Treader at center.
Yeah.
Right? And that was part of that nucleus on the offensive line. I do think Jedrick Wills at left tackle, who's had two subpar seasons, will get better. I think his trajectory will be fine. I love Amari Cooper. At the same time, last year at this time, we're talking about OBJ and Jarvis Landry being there and Rashard Higgins. So you're replacing those guys with Amari Cooper and Donovan Peoples-Jones and whatever you get from Anthony Schwartz and David Bell. I don't know that that's an upgrade. On paper, I'm saying last year going into the season, I thought that the Browns had one of the best all-around rosters in the NFL. I think they still have weaknesses on the defensive line, on the interior in particular.
Yeah.
I don't know that the Browns are better this year from a roster perspective. We ranked them sixth here. The Browns are similar to the Cowboys for me this offseason, where it's tough to put Watson aside because that will, if he plays football, he makes a lot of these other things better, I believe. But I think the Browns and the Cowboys had better all-around rosters last year than this year. They're still good, but I think they were better last year.
Yeah. Maybe Cleveland's roster top to bottom is a slight step behind where it was a year ago. Part of it is you know, we assumed OBJ would come good last year. Eventually, it just never happened with Baker Mayfield. So he's not as good as a player for Cleveland last year on paper as you would have thought he was. So Amari Cooper is an upgrade over the OBJ that Cleveland ever had. You know, Deshaun Watson thing is important. The other thing is this kind of highlights the thing you're talking about, right? How easy it is for this to decline and fall apart and erode over an offseason or two. This is why, if Cleveland ends up in a situation where they're starting Jacoby Brissett for the year, this is why it's important, right? Because you just burned a year of keeping this group together. That's next season you might lose two or three of these guys, and you go from having a top five roster in the NFL to having a top 10 or, you know, middle tier, and now you're suddenly needing the quarterback to come in and raise the level of an average roster, as opposed to this team is capable of winning a Super Bowl right now if we have elite quarterback play. That's why, again, I'm not going to rehash last episode, but that's why the Browns might not want to go hat in hand to Baker Mayfield. That's the update, by the way. Do you see him at his quarterback camp or his kids camp or whatever it is? He's I think both sides moved on, but you know, they would have to come to me, you know, essentially hat in hand, Baker.
You make the move,
right,
Andrew Berry?
Which I think is fair. And as people have pointed out, there's quite a lot of irony in, you know. Remember the Browns had that? It wasn't even them that said it publicly, but it was a report that came out. You know, unnamed sources in Cleveland said they were pursuing Deshaun Watson because they wanted an adult, you know, at quarterback, as opposed to Baker Mayfield, this childlike, petty, you know.
Maybe he's grown up this offseason.
Baker's there at a, you know, football camp for kids, and the same day that Deshaun Watson is meeting with the NFL and his lawyers about how much he's going to get suspended based off all of his legal problems. I'm just saying that, if the Browns are in a situation where Watson is suspended the whole year, there's a lot of argument to say you probably should go cap in hand to Baker Mayfield and say, hey, I know we hate each other right now, but can we stay together for the kids for 1 year to try and win a Super Bowl?
Then OBJ's still out there. You bring OBJ, get the band back together.
Did you see the painting that I commissioned for himself, I guess?
No.
It was Rams OBJ helping up Cleveland OBJ, you know, who's really? Lying prone on the floor. It was lifting him up. That's what OBJ thinks about teaming back up with Baker Mayfield.
A creative masterpiece.
Really, yeah. Gotta love it.
Maybe he's implying that Browns OBJ has been pulled back up. He's okay now. He was on the ground. Now he's back up after the Rams. He's got a ring.
I don't think he wants to go back down to the turf again, though.
Maybe not.
But anyway, my point being, it's not easy to maintain a championship caliber roster in the NFL, right? The entire system is set up to prevent you doing that. Now, it's possible, but most teams are not able to achieve that for any length of time. And if you have one of those rosters, to willingly sacrifice that to go a whole year starting Jacoby Brissett is, in my opinion, negligent.
Where else do you want to go here? We got the Eagles I mentioned at 7.
It's Cincinnati. Eight.
Bengals at 8.
That, given where they were a year ago. Remember, rewind, right? The Bengals were the bottom team in that division. They got Joe Burrow at number one overall a couple of years ago. all of a sudden they go to a Super Bowl and, you know, everyone's sort of looking at that, wow, what a run, but they overachieve. Like, this team isn't that good. And then in the course of an offseason, they overhaul an offensive line, they make inroads into weak positions, and all of a sudden now they're legitimately a top 10 roster in an NFL that's loading up with all its contenders and are genuine contenders.
I know this is a very specific example, but go back to that bridge quarterback debate, right? Joe Burrow got hurt in year one, and they were forced to play, well, they had Ryan Finley and Brandon Allen and his backups, right? That earns the Bengals the fifth overall pick. That nets them Ja'Marr Chase. Mm-hmm. After you get your quarterback, is it actually better to have one more year picking in the top 10 just to get another great player? One more year, because that's how year two Bengals, year two Joe Burrow led them to a Super Bowl. So you got your quarterback, maybe you sit him just so you're bad again and you get another, and then, I mean, Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase make this team a contender.
Yeah.
And then don't sleep on T. Higgins and Tyler Boyd, right? I love rolling three deep at receiver. When you have Ja'Marr Chase, T. Higgins, and Tyler Boyd, now you have an offensive line that can protect well enough. That is why the Bengals have a very good roster.
That might be a strategy if you could consistently, you know, snag an all-time record setter at
an important position.
If that was your plan, you know? Like, if you could say, hey, we're going to deliberately stink next year, get a top five pick, and then get one of the greatest players to ever hit their rookie season next season.
I would do that. I would.
That would be a good strategy, right? Yeah. If you could reliably predict that every single year, I would say absolutely. That's a sacrifice I'm willing to make. But I don't trust your ability to do that. So, no.
We have the Chiefs at 9. And here's my question. Where would they be? With Tyreek Hill or without Tyreek Hill, right? Or where'd they be without... I'm saying with Tyreek Hill...
Okay.
On the roster,
yeah,
and fewer draft picks versus Tyreek Hill off the roster. Because, by the way, the Dolphins are at 10, and they're up there in part because they added Tyreek Hill and Teron Armstead and all these big names to a roster that was already pretty good, right? A team that's already won. They won a bunch of games these last couple years. Yeah, where would the Chiefs be with and without Patrick Mahomes, too, is also fair.
Well, without Tyreek Hill, it's like saying, where would the Chiefs be with Tyreek Hill but minus two of Sky Moore, Trent McDuffie, and George Karlaftis, right? And probably one of Juju and Marquez Valdes-Scantling as well. So essentially taking three of those five players off their roster, but adding Tyreek Hill back in.
And you would go unit by unit and saying, they still probably need some help at receiver because you want more. You'd probably need some help in the secondary. You probably still need some help on the defensive line. And this is the spread the wealth type of theory for the Chiefs. And I think that's why on paper they look like a top 10 roster because they were able to fill those spots.
Yeah.
But same answer as the Packers here. Even though the Chiefs look like they have better depth than they did last year at this time, if the receiving core, all of the receivers, plus Travis Kelce, if they're not good enough, the Chiefs won't be good enough.
My answer to that first question, the with or without Tyreek Hill thing, I think this team is better with Tyreek Hill, even if you take away three of those five guys.
Sure.
I think that's a net win, adding Tyreek Hill back in. The real question to me is like, okay, you take Patrick Mahomes off this roster, where is it? And it's like, I mean, it's middle of the pack, and that would be based entirely off the offensive line.
It's a fair point, Sam. And you could, if you slapped Zach Wilson in at quarterback,
right,
and you said, how has the team done to build around Zach Wilson in year two? And you put him on the Chiefs roster, you would say, he's got one of the best offensive lines in the NFL. Great job there.
Travis Kelce.
He's got Travis Kelce.
Subpar wide receiver group outside of that.
But you would say, man, I really wish he had better receivers to throw to overall. I really wish we did a better job. I think with Valdes-Scantling, Juju Smith-Schuster, Sky Moore. Or would you say, you know what? That group as a whole, it's kind of like what the Patriots have built.
Yeah.
With Mac Jones.
That's
right?
What I was thinking of. So it's a lot like the Patriots. You'd be looking at this and you'd say, great offensive line. Superstar Travis Kelce, superstar Chris Jones, not much else. Which is fine. Like, that would probably put you in the middle of the pack somewhere. But it's not like, you know, we're not looking at this and saying this is a contending team. Like, this is a team with an average roster, a great offensive line that's being propelled into perennial contender status by Patrick Mahomes, who's a freak show.
So we have the Chiefs at 9, Dolphins at 10. And that'll be interesting, right? Because we're accounting for the quarterback here. I think Ben Lindsay, as he's putting this together, is actually saying the Dolphins overall, player for player, probably do have a better roster than the Chiefs. But we trust, obviously, Mahomes over Tua. But yeah, the Dolphins will be.
I think that's overrating Miami.
Oh, I don't think so at all, man.
Look, Miami two spots ahead of Baltimore?
I think it's underrating Baltimore that more than anything.
I mean, okay, Baltimore has a similar problem to Green Bay in terms of that's not a good wide receiver group.
Yeah, but
on the other hand, they need it less.
Right. That's they're going to throw the ball 200 fewer times than the Packers
right.
next year. But I think the Dolphins, this is going back to my Eagles debate. Where are your strengths? I think when you look at the Dolphins, it's like pass catchers, secondary.
Yeah,
those are your strengths.
The problem I have with the pass catchers thing is I need to be shown how the Tyreek Hill and Jalen Waddle thing is going to work.
You just run them. They just go play football.
They just go.
Yes.
They just go.
That's you what run pass concepts.
That's what the Jags were asking last year. Just go out and play, guys.
Yeah, but the players were named Tavon Austin and Laquan Treadwell. That's the difference. Go play football.
You're just naming a pair of first round players right there.
True.
Equal talent.
Trevor Lawrence was throwing to more first-round receivers than Aaron Rodgers has ever had.
That's what I'm saying.
And what was Trevor doing? Man. Because the players are named Tyreek Hill, Jalen Waddle, Cedric Wilson, Mike Gesicki. You don't need a plan. You play football. What do you mean
a plan? There needs to be a scheme that allows both those guys to function at the same time.
Yeah. Tyreek Hill, run some deep routes. Jalen Waddle,
I'm not saying it's impossible.
Less.
I'm saying I haven't seen it yet, and the 49ers had a history of not being able to achieve that.
Achieve what?
The 49ers could not get more than one superstar firing at the same time in that offense. Like when Debo Samuel was dominating, George Kittle wasn't. When Debo Samuel was off the field, George Kittle would take over. Like you need
that's good.
It's good, but you need.
That's good for winning games. You're not. The goal is not.
But the
I need Tyreek Hill to have 120 catches. I need Jalen Waddle to have 100. Oh no, Mike Gesicki's only going to have 50. We got to get him 75. How do we do it? That's not what you're trying to do.
No, but what you're doing when that happens is you're not getting the sum of the two guys. Like the sum of Jalen Waddle and Tyreek Hill is potentially phenomenal. But if only one of them fires at any moment, you're not getting the sum. You're getting a percentage of that.
I think you. But you measure it by something objective around the offense, not their production. You measure it around something like EPA and actually putting points on the board. If the Dolphins are putting points on the board and Tyreek Hill's getting 130 catches and Waddle's not, he's getting 50, but they have the highest scoring offense in the NFL, I'm going to be under the assumption that it's all working, right? And it's working. Tyreek Hill might be the beneficiary. Waddle might be the beneficiary. But it's working because those guys are drawing coverage and they're fast and Gesicki's tough to cover and Hill and Waddle are tough to cover and they have a better offensive line and they have fast running backs that are, you know, within a nice Shanahan system. So you got to judge it not based off of the production of the receivers. You judge it by the production of the offense. And I think they're going to be fine in that regard, assuming Tua is not terrible.
I mean, possibly. I was trying to load up your PFF Ultimate thing here to find out where the 49ers actually ranked in EPA per play.
We're deploying right now.
Yeah, but it won't load.
We're in the middle of deploying right now.
That's I thought that wasn't supposed to happen during podcast episodes.
Oh yeah, I did get a message. Is anything happening right now where we shouldn't deploy?
Yeah, this is. So I can't tell you where the 49ers ranked.
We're fine. We really try to do it around when we're at in team buildings.
Yeah.
Made a mistake a few weeks ago. We were right in the middle of presenting IQ to a team.
Yeah, that would be bad.
And we mistimed our production deploy. Can't have that.
No.
So that was...
Because otherwise you're sitting here refreshing and nothing's happening.
That was embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's not going to be back for a couple minutes probably.
Perfect.
So you're not going to get your... Not going to get your answer.
Okay.
Just yet. Anyway. I like the Dolphins roster. I like where they're strong.
I mean, I think it's fine. I just think we're overrating it a little bit.
Saints at 11. Ravens too low at 12?
I think the Ravens are underrated here. Yes, I think that's a good roster. The receiving group is not ideal. But otherwise, it's very good. Okay, 49. I found it elsewhere. I've had to go to alternative avenues for my EPA per play.
Source it.
Don't.
It doesn't matter.
The running backs don't matter, place.
No.
RBS, DM, Bang. Whatever. Where are they? 1, 2, 3, 4. It's difficult to tell because it's done by chart, you know, the visual, the graph thing.
It's a scatter.
So yeah, there you go. That's the word. They are around 18. Sixth.
Who?
The 49ers.
Oh, the 49ers.
Offensive EPA per play last year. About sixth, I think, behind Tampa Bay, Green Bay, Kansas City, Buffalo, the Chargers, and possibly Dallas.
Right. And so how do you interpret that as bad? Because Debo had good games and Kittle had good games, but they didn't have good games at the same time?
I didn't say it was bad. I said it wasn't maximizing the sum of the players they've got.
Are you kidding me?
No.
You have Jimmy Garoppolo at quarterback, and all of the teams that are higher than you have much better quarterbacks. This is the reason why we call Kyle Shanahan Tin Cup. This is the reason why we've elevated Kyle Shanahan.
You that we. You're out here with like one functional metaphor in the last 3 years. That
I can
me.
Still borrow yours.
No.
I can borrow yours too. Listen, there's a reason why we elevate Kyle Shanahan to the top of play callers, because historically you're like, Matt Schaub, look at those numbers. Get Matt Schaub in the Hall of Fame. It's like, well, no, he had Shanahan. Matt Ryan, elevate him to MVP. RG3, one of the best rookie seasons of all time. And then you have Jimmy Garoppolo, who is a worse quarterback than every other team that had higher EPA per play, higher, better production. And you say, well, the difference there is the playmakers and the play caller. Debo Samuel, George Kittle, Brandon Ayuk, when his head's on straight and they trust him, and Jimmy Garoppolo is the facilitator. That's what the Dolphins are trying to build there. So you get a whole bunch of guys who are difficult to cover, that are fast, that have tough skill sets for the defense. You get a facilitator there at quarterback. So if the Dolphins end up 6th or 7th in EPA per play this year, is that a win?
Yeah, but my point is all that happens because Shanahan is Tin Cup, right? Because Shanahan can take a collection of gardening tools and shoot 67 on a golf course with them, which is why Nick Mullins appears on graphics with Andrew Luck and Patrick Mahomes in terms of like yardage thrown through the first, whatever, 13 starts of his career. Why C.J. Beathard can have the same yards per attempt figure as Aaron Rodgers. Like, that happens because of Shanahan. Let's assume that Mike McDaniel is not Shanahan, because there's one. There's one Shanahan. He's the guy that runs his system different to everybody else, even if they're on the same family tree and they came from the same place and blah, blah. Kyle Shanahan is the thing here. And so you're automatically getting this boost through Kyle Shanahan being Tin Cup, right? Then you're asking, right, now what are the playmakers doing? What is the, on paper, the fact that I have George Kittle, the best, the most talented tight end of the NFL, I would argue. You've got Brandon Ayuk, incredibly talented first round pick. You got Debo Samuel, incredibly talented, multi-dimensional hybrid weapon, blah, blah. Collectively, that should be the best receiving group in the NFL, propelling this already absurd cheat code that is Kyle Shanahan into untold stratospheres of offensive production. But it isn't, because you don't get the sum of those three guys at the same time. So when we're looking at this Miami Dolphins offense and we're saying, wow, we have Tyreek Hill on one hand and the closest thing to Tyreek Hill on the other hand, put those two together and we have like a million yards and this is the best offense we've ever seen. But you're not going to get that, or at least I see no evidence so far that you're going to get that. You're going to get a percentage of that, which is less than what we're giving it credit for by looking at it on paper.
Where do you think the Niners should rank in EPA per play, say, with that group?
With the offense, if you're able to rank in, you know, if you're able to rank highly with Nick Mullins and C.J. Beathard at quarterback, with that group of playmakers, they should be better than that. Like, Kyle Shanahan is already taking what shouldn't function and making it good.
We know that the quarterback's the biggest driver of all this production.
Yeah.
And if the comparison, you have top 4 to 8 quarterbacks like Josh Allen, Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, Patrick Mahomes, whoever. All those are the teams that are ranked ahead. Then you have Jimmy Garoppolo, who, if you're ranking quarterbacks, probably doesn't rank above 15, right? He's somewhere 13th to 24th in your quarterback rankings. That's what you have. And you're ranking near the top quarterbacks, you're winning. That's a win for the offense. I don't care if you have Tyreek Hill, Randy Moss, and Jerry Rice out there. So,
I mean, I would care quite a bit if I had that.
But if Tua's your quarterback, you still might not have the best, because Tua's not as good as the other quarterbacks who are a bigger driver than the receivers I just mentioned. You still might not have the best offense in the NFL. Would the Dolphins have the best offense at the NFL if it was Tyreek Hill, Randy Moss, and Jerry Rice? Maybe, but is that expected? Tua's still the bigger driver than any of this.
Yeah, and Tua's below average. So if Tua's below average and he's the biggest driver, they don't have a top 10 roster. If my point is simply that I think we are overrating the potential combination of Tyreek Hill and Jaylen Waddle, A, without seeing it function, and B, with prior history of the fact that that typically reduces or produces less than 100% of what you assume the combination of those two would produce.
I like where the Dolphins are.
I mean, I think they're a...
What else stands out to you
here? Worse roster than the Ravens, probably the 49ers, maybe Denver.
Cowboys at 16.
Yeah.
That the point I made earlier where I don't think... Do we overrate the offseason feels, right? 2 years ago, the Packers had bad feels coming out of the offseason, right? They drafted Jordan Love. They drafted fullbacks in the top three rounds, all this stuff. Didn't feel great for the Packers. They had the best record in the NFL, I believe, that year. Whatever. They're the number one seed in 2020. Are we overrating the feels for the Cowboys here? Where they lose a starting guard, they lose Randy Gregory starting on the edge, and they lose Amari Cooper.
No, I think...
It's kind of the opposite of like what the Chargers did,
they might
right?
be a little bit underrated, but there's a lot of like average on this roster when you look at it. Now, it's average in ways that could get better.
Average is good.
It also could improve. It is, but average is also, you know, in the middle of the NFL.
True.
16th, for example. So, yeah, like I'm less concerned about like the individual players that they've lost and more just when you start laying it out and you say, well, how many of these guys are just kind of banging in the middle, an average? That's my bigger issue. Like, losing Amari Cooper, I think, is a step backwards, even if Jalen Tolbert, I like that as a potential solution. Michael Gallup's going to miss a lot of the season. Like, I think they're talking December for him to come back.
For Gallup?
Yeah.
December?
I think so.
I did not know that.
Certainly going to miss time. We're not going to see, like, 100% Michael Gallup right away. Let me just check. I'm not confusing him with somebody else. But, like, that's a step back in a receiving core at a spot where we know it has a huge influence on the kind of Dak Prescott you're going
to
get.
I want to go to the other end of the spectrum here, too. The teams that are at the bottom. Houston Texans, 32.
Yikes.
Atlanta Falcons are 31. Chicago Bears are at 30. We've kind of hammered that point home that Bears have been moving in the wrong direction for a while here. Seattle Seahawks at 29, and the Jacksonville Jaguars still at 28.
Okay, I might be confusing them with somebody else. Okay. Gallup expected to return in September is the most recent USA Today.
It's way before
column.
December.
It is. Yeah. It's months, in fact, before December.
Teams ranking in the 20s, teams like OBJ. The Jaguars, who made a lot of additions this offseason. The Giants, who, you know, probably had a nice little draft. It's top-heavy draft that helped with the two top seven picks. The Lions, we liked a lot about what the Lions did. We have them at 25th, and we like a lot about what the Jets have done and have them 24th. But all those teams still have questions at quarterback. And even with good additions, I'd say, especially with the Jets and Lions along their roster. And you have to say the Jaguars, take the money out of the equation. They definitely upgraded their football players this offseason. But it's tough to rank them any higher until we actually see it on the field.
A lot of people were big mad that I had Seattle as number 32 in the power rankings, my power rankings. But like, this is why. This is a bad roster. Number 29 in this list. And they have maybe the worst quarterback situation in the NFL. Like, that's a recipe for stinking.
Yeah, I don't know how you could have that much faith in Geno Smith or Drew Locke.
There's a weird
with this
group of people that are Geno Smith truthers.
I think the Geno Smith truthers are, I mentioned Greg Rosenthal. It's people that have had Twitter for 10 years now. And Geno Smith was the top quarterback in 2013 in a lot of people's minds. And you always just, it was a lot like this year where you just assume quarterbacks are going to go high and then they didn't. And it's like, well, I thought Geno was going to go number one. And he just never got a fair shake. He was only a second round pick. He didn't get those opportunities.
It's also, you know.
And he had a couple good games last year.
Yeah. Like 5 touchdowns, 1 interception in limited snaps last year. Passer rating of 103. Like, those are the kind of numbers where you can convince yourself.
You know what else he did?
Extrapolated forward.
You know what else? I think there's people who were truthers since his like West Virginia days. There's also people who saw Thursday Night Football, Island game. They hadn't scored a point, right, with Russ before Russ got hurt. And then all of a sudden, it was Geno Smith against the Rams, right? And he's just leading him back, throws a jump ball to DK Metcalf or whatever. The corner falls. Geno Smith almost led a comeback against the Super Bowl champion Rams in front of the nation.
He did. Sure. I'm just saying there's more evidence.
Just trying to explain the mentality of the truthers here.
I mean, I kind of get it. I'm just, it feels a little bit like one of those things where, you know, at this point, you should probably know better.
Here's the thing about Seattle, right? Because it's not just the quarterback. You lose both starting tackles. Dwayne Brown turned that offensive line over the last 5 years from like bottom three to bottom 10. Pretty significant. You lose both starting tackles. You lose a very good starting corner in DJ Reed. You lose Bobby Wagner, right? Obviously, you lose Russell Wilson. I'm just saying the other parts of this roster getting a little bit worse. Younger. They're rebuilding. It's a rebuilding roster, and they have two top whatever receivers.
Another team fascinatingly ranked is Arizona. They are all the way down in 23rd for a team that made the playoffs last year. For a decent portion of the season, looked like one of the best teams in the NFL. And then obviously, as has been their strategy over the last trajectory over the last few years, drives off a cliff late in the season.
It's another team, Arizona, that has bad offseason feels, right?
It's bad. It's not even bad offseason feels. It's like the season finishes badly, so the offseason feels terribly all the time. Like every offseason for Arizona feels terrible because they just got wrecked towards the end of the season. So we don't look at it like, you know, big picture. This team has gone from terrible first overall pick to less terrible to decent, you know, to okay to good. We don't look at that like arc. And yeah, I forget, I think Connor McQuiston's coach rankings had Cliff Kingsbury actually ranked surprisingly high. Like, there's a lot of things to like about this Arizona team, but it never feels that way because the seasons always end so badly. So until they figure that thing out, it feels terrible for everybody.
Yeah, I think for me, though, it's more you look at, I don't trust their corners, again, relative to the rest of the league.
Right, but after a season where that's just been like, you know, where they played all year, like that wasn't the problem.
Yeah, I get it, but it doesn't mean that that's a good thing going in. I like a little bit what they did at tight end within the draft and all that stuff. But you got, you know, AJ Green's coming back. You trade for Marquise Brown. It feels like last year's Raiders a little bit, where I liked some of the moves. I didn't like some of the other moves. Whereas other teams, you're like, I see a point in all of these moves. I think you're getting better across the board. But you lose to Chandler Jones, but you have J.J. Watt coming back. All these different things. It's like, yeah, but this.
AJ Green has a fascinating split that you can find in Premium Stats. Part of an elite subscription, a PFF. We have a breakdown of play for receivers receiving players and defensive players against versus man and zone, right? So receiving versus scheme is what it's called in the premium stats breakdown. You get the grade and numbers versus man coverage and versus zone coverage. And, you know, teams are playing less man coverage than ever before, but it's still an important thing. And generally speaking, the best players excel against man coverage because you need to have, you know, your physical skill set on point in order to thrive that way. AJ Green obviously declining, you know, not the player that he once was. He's still able to have some success, though. And he has one of the most absurd splits between man and zone coverage. So AJ Green still has one of the best grades in the NFL against zone coverage, but not against man coverage. So
sounds about right.
Yeah, like he's the best graded player on the Cardinals against zone coverage. So he has a better grade against zone than DeAndre Hopkins does. 82 receiving grade, but against man, he has one of the worst grades in the NFL. Because he's just lost it physically. He just isn't the same guy that he used to be. So if a guy is manned up one-on-one, AJ Green's not getting open and, you know, may not be winning at the catch point anymore and blah, blah, blah. He's just not doing well. But put him against zone, the dude hasn't lost like a decade of savvy and understanding and, you know, play. He knows where to be at the right time and knows how to exploit holes in his zone. So I just think it's interesting sort of finally getting a data point that actually illustrates what's happening to AJ Green, which is, you know, he's reached that point in his career where he's declining physically. He's not able to run the way he used to. He's not able to do the things that he used to do physically, but he still understands how to play the game, and that will take you quite a long way, depending on the offense you play, depending on the defense you play.
It's also nice when you have Marquise Brown as another option there, Rondale Moore, but you have DeAndre Hopkins. This is like the yeah buts I'm talking about with Arizona.
Yeah.
Right? On paper, things look good. Yeah, but DeAndre Hopkins is missing the first six games, you know?
And that's hard.
J.J. Watt coming back, yeah, but you lose Chandler Jones. You don't really have another great replacement there.
The DeAndre Hopkins thing is difficult for this type of exercise because you're like, well, we're ranking rosters. He's on the roster. He's just going to miss six games. What do you do with that? Like, do you count him? Is he 100%?
No, you just take 35.
Superstar DeAndre, already, yeah.
35.3% out of it, you know.
Yeah, so he's 65% of DeAndre Hopkins is what we're counting for this exercise.
If you're 6 for 17, you're hitting 353.
Okay.
Just saying.
That's fine.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else? We got to wrap this thing up.
No. So head over to pff.com, and it's one of the articles on the front page somewhere, or if not, it won't have slipped very far by the time you're listening to this. NFL roster rankings for all 32 teams.
Shout out to Ben Lindsay, though, doing great work over at PFF. He is he's one of our liaisons for Sunday Night Football, mm-hmm. NBC. So a lot of the data and stuff basically – Chris doesn't know what he's doing unless Ben Lindsay tells him, is wow. what I've learned, right?
Whew.
Chris doesn't have any... Oh, we'll cut that part out, too. I'm just kidding. Does Chris make it to this part of the podcast? No, I'm just saying. Ben does a lot of good work helping Chris out in his preparation for Sunday Night Football as well.
Yeah, so. And I think he heads up sort of all the TV package stuff. Like everything that goes out to various networks is now under Ben's purview.
So anyway, while you're at PFF.com, 25% off using the promo code NFLPOD, exclusive for our PFF NFL podcast listeners. Use it, NFLPOD, 25% off. Keep sending those emails in. Love it. Fuels a lot of our conversation and a lot of the discussions we're going to be having here throughout the summer. We'll be back on 4th of July. We might be wearing the same thing. I don't know. We'll see. I might just really like the shirt, and I want to rock it on Monday morning.
And why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't I? So we'll be back for you on 4th of July on Monday morning. We'll see you then.